Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save It for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community. With that, we can start another episode of Save for the Blind. So I'd like to start the introduction. I've got Jeff Smith to my left, my normal co-host. And across the table, we have Yancey Forrest Knowles, historian of California waterfowling. So, Yancey, welcome to the Save for the Blind podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me to spend the day with you. And it's great being with both Jeff and Carson because of our longtime relationship through CWA. And it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to learning the history of waterfowling and in our state. So I know
me too, Jeff.
Yeah. I know it's rich. I know very little, and I want to learn. So appreciate you having us at your house today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. You want to go into a little bit of background about yourself with your work with CWA, how you got, I guess, interested in California waterfowling and the history before we dive into the actual history part of it?
You bet. You know, I think I probably would like to mention that, you know, my DNA was tapped into when I was very young. My first memory is really walking behind my dad in a pheasant field at about 4.5 years old, and started actually hunting with him at about 10 or 11. I've got some great memories. I grew up in Palo Alto and hunted the bay quite a bit. And it was a time when, it was a time about two things. Sprig were still the king bird in California, but I remember distinctly riding my bicycle through town at 11 years old with my 410, you know, strapped on the handlebars and riding out to the bay and just shooting at will and occasionally even hitting a duck. But, you know, that's the kind of place that California was at that time. There were about 12 million people in the state, dramatically different than what I would say is probably 50 million today. And, you know, when I talk to younger people and, you know, they might ask, you know, was the sky dark with ducks? And I'd say, yeah, you know, certain times it was. Opening day was, there was a lot of ducks and it was kind of crazy. There were so many and just flying all over the place and hard to focus on any particular duck. And some big storms, you'd see flights that would go on all day. But the real difference that I want to emphasize is the fact that you could always find a place to hunt. Refuges did not have lotteries. Not a lot of people were using them. I mean, in the sense of you could, I remember many, many times driving over with my uncle to the grasslands area, Mendota specifically. We hunted there a lot. We'd go over Friday night after he got off of work and we'd stop and have dinner on the way and get there 8:30, 9 o'clock. There might be 6 or 7 cars in front of us. And opening day, there might be 25 cars in front of us, but on a 10,000-acre refuge, you know, it was nothing. And so you could go to the bay anytime you wanted. You could drive through the Central Valley, and there were, you know, there were sugar beet fields everywhere in those times, and that's why the pheasant hunting was so good. But you could stop and just get out and walk up one row and shoot a nice pheasant and come down the other row and shoot another one, get your limit and hop in the car and take off. That's the kind of land that was available. And you could talk to ranchers and farmers and introduce yourself. And a lot of times they would give you permission. So that's really the biggest difference. And so after that time, you know, I spent time as an artillery battery commander 5 years during Vietnam. Finished my education through the University of California, graduate work at St. Mary's. Got very involved in rafting after that time and worked with a group of guys, and we developed most of the rivers for commercial rafting in the state. There were only a few rivers being commercially rafted at that time. So I spent about 10 years guiding rafting trips, and then did a lot of trips for specifically for fishing too, in some of the rivers that couldn't be approached any other way. So that was a great time in my life. Get professionally trained as an educator, was a teacher for about 10 years, and then spent 20 years as a principal here in Sonoma County. Have served on a lot of boards and foundations. And one I'm most proud of course, is I had the wonderful opportunity to chair the CWA board. Did a lot of work for COA, the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation, working a lot with the Pacific Flyway Center, and the phenomenal job that Claude Grillo is doing there now. And one of the things I'm most proud of is I, in February, received a wonderful phone call and was nominated and then inducted into the California Outdoors Hall of Fame. And there's some great, great people there. John Muir, Ansel Adams, Kit Carson, Yvonne Chouinard, the list goes on. So somehow I was invited to join that wonderful group. You know, the greatest thing and the reason we're here today is when my interest of not just waterfowling, and I'm a dedicated waterfowler, but the history of waterfowling just captured me. And I started about 60 years ago and spent that time and drove about 55,000 miles in California and some other states too, but primarily California, garnering the information. I went to most of the major museums, libraries, news agencies, private collections, so on and so forth. And not just the history, the actual history, but I just fell in love with the archival photographs and was fortunate enough to put a really fine collection together. You know, of photographs going back as far as 1870s. And used that in working with my partner, Dr. Wayne Kaputh, who lives in Memphis, Tennessee, the expert on the Mississippi Flyway and has the most phenomenal, the biggest and most meaningful collection of archival photographs in the nation. He and I sat down together and put a book together, and it was a labor of love. It's the Pacific Flyway, you know, archival photographs. And I think we did a pretty decent job with it. We had a nice response and did three printings, and they all went out the door right away. And so that was kind of the last, you know, thing of any mention I would share with you. And that's that is enough about me, you know. But I wanted to make sure and respond to your question.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I did want to ask you. I mean, what did it mean to you being inducted into the Hall of Fame?
It was a mixture of emotions. You know, why me? How do I possibly rank with some of those people? But it was a greatly appreciated, a real honor. And it's kind of a statement of saying, you know what, you did accomplish something. You know, you did bring some information and knowledge to people in the state and help garner an appreciation for the great outdoors here. And you've had some influence. And to have that said about you is very honorable, and I'm greatly appreciated.
That's a huge accomplishment, and congratulations. I mean, you've given back to the hunting community tremendously, but let's step back in time here. Let's go back to where it all started here in California.
Yeah. Well, let me share a little something I put together here. And, you know, California is certainly the most important location in the Pacific Flyway. And it indeed is among the most important locations in all of North America. 73% of the waterfowl in the Pacific Flyway and 23% from overall the four flyways come to California every year to spend their winter here. Now, it has some of the largest concentrations of waterfowl in the nation, about 6.5 million birds. It's is the general opinion and estimation that come here, both ducks and geese, and during the the height of the winter migration. And at the times of at the time of statehood in 1850, it's estimated that there were 20 to 40 million birds in California. Well, can you imagine that?
No.
I mean, we've all seen some of the amazing concentrations of birds, whether we're fortunate enough to see it at a duck club or at one of the state or federal refuges, or just in the sky as we're driving down Highway 5 in the Central Valley. You know, we've all seen that, and it still takes our breath away. But 20 to 40 million? And that's an estimation, of course. They didn't really have any way of determining that. But it's said that, you know, the sky was dark when the birds got up, and the sound was that of a hurricane. That many birds. So California itself was once an actual sea of reeds, from the coast to the mountains and even along the desert tributaries. And the extent of the vast marshlands, it's really hard to grasp today. But searching for archival information and photos, I, along with some other great historians, have pieced together a small but very valuable sense of what it was like. Initially, there were some 5 million acres of wetlands, most of which was in the Central Valley. But by the turn of the 20th century, there are only some 300,000 acres of wetlands left in California. Now, fortunately, with the growth of the federal and the state refuges, and private duck clubs, the figure has rebounded some. It's getting back up to about 2.5 million. So that's a very exciting and great thing to share with people. Now, there are hints in the early Spanish accounts and U.S. explorers' journals describing the vast plain of the valley as a labyrinth of lakes and tules. And the tules, they were so thick, there was a word that described it. They were called tulares, you know, an accommodation, just a massive amount of tules together. And they grew, believe it or not, on either side of the Sacramento River, about 10 miles on each side. You know, because the river, of course, would flood virtually every spring or winter, and the tulares were sustained. And it actually, you know, there was just not a country in the world or a location in the nation that abounded in the waterfowl that we had here, or other game, you know, for that matter as well. And, you know, in a nutshell, California is a critical wintering ground for waterfowl. In comparisons to other areas in the nation, and especially the Atlantic and Mississippi flyways, California has produced only a relatively small number of careful observers. By 1880, though, the significant decrease in abundance of waterfowl, perhaps as much as 50% decrease, were already evident and noted by observers. First of all, this was due to market hunting, and then later due to reclamation for agriculture and other areas of population. Now, California is unique among the four flyways for a multitude of reasons, including the number of waterfowl clubs. There have been 3,000 plus over time, and a good 1,000 that are active today. It's due to the number of birds present during the height of the migration, both ducks and geese. It's due to particular hunting strategies. We had some unique things take place here. Not only the number of clubs, but we had something called pit hunting. And we had something called bull hunting. And it wasn't hunting for bulls. It was using them, of course, to stalk flocks of birds. you know, the extent and variety of habitats here is quite amazing. We have tidal marshes, rivers, sloughs, lakes, and man-made wetlands. And the number of distinct basins that we have, there's 13 of them. The diversity of landforms and the diversity of climate zones and the migration patterns that are associated with them. And some of the oldest waterfowl hunting clubs in the nation, especially those that are still active today, dating back to 1867. And we'll talk about those today. The role that the clubs have played in conservation, you know, maintaining and even enhancing the wetlands through improved wetland management, you know, for example, moist soil management and better water control. The role of extensive and varied agriculture has played, the wheat, the corn, the rice, even lettuce. We'll talk about that. The number of early clubs in Southern California, absolutely amazing history. And the amazing harvest numbers. We're still harvesting over 1 million birds a year in California. The most recent data I got was a million point two five. And this is all done in a state with a huge population, perhaps as many as 50 million people. You know, today's migrating waterfowl have been arriving in a state that's far, far different from the one that was known to their forebears. From the time that California's statehood in 1850, wetlands experienced nearly a century of accelerated losses as they were drained and reclaimed. Now, the fate of California wetlands has paralleled broader trends across the entire United States. The loss of America's wetlands represents, quite simply, from my perspective, the loss of one of our greatest and important treasures. And as profound as the nationwide losses are, they pale in comparison to those suffered in California. What we are as a society, what we do with our water, from whom and where we take it, and to whom and where we deliver it, I think it reveals a great deal about our values and our relationships with nature. Now, we're going to use this background to look at specific areas with historical wetlands, both they were, where they were in the state, and their original conditions, their changes over time and their status today, and certainly their future. Along with this, we're going to look at and try to compare today the estimated original number of migrating waterfowl and the specific wetlands that they wintered in. And the earliest estimates, as I had mentioned in the 1870s, that in the nation itself, there were about 221 million acres of wetlands in the 48 states. But by the end of the 20th century, there were only 105 million acres, a loss of some 48%. And again, from my perspective, it pales in comparison to California, where we, by the 1980s, had lost 91% of our wetlands. Now, following the gold rush until the end of the Civil War, market and sport hunting of waterfowl boomed in California. The first hunting was basically for subsistence, then followed by market hunting, and then was sport hunting. And with these conditions and settings, we're going to look at how economic development, advances in transportation, very large farming enterprises, and mining and extensive timber operations, and ultimately, the luxury of more leisure time and more money facilitated the development of more organized or club hunting. Included today, you know, we'll try to look at the identification of the ages of historically important duck clubs and their histories and their traditions and their present state of condition. And in addition, information on limits and harvest numbers over time throughout the state will be addressed. Now, the role that California duck clubs played in conservation beginning in the mid-20th century was immeasurable. By many standards, duck clubs in California have been essential for the continued existence of wetlands, as well as the actual increase of waterfowl. Now, at this point in both the state and on the federal level. We will explore the many legislative aspects of wetland and waterfowl conservation. And, you know, their long-term effects on our hunting heritage. And we can find out that, you know, clubs can generally be grouped as to when they developed and where they developed in different areas. We've got the area with San Francisco and the Sassoon Marsh in the coastal areas. Another area is the central area with the Butte Sink, the Grasslands, and then you have the Tulare Basin. You have Southern California and the interior, and of course, Klamath, Humboldt. So different areas that the clubs grew in and developed at certain times. Now, California waterfowl and our wetlands face an uncertain future, subject to continuing pressure from population growth, from urban expansion and economic development, as well now as the threat from global climate change. Efforts to protect and restore wetlands have gained significant momentum, and this momentum is going to be carried into the future. I personally believe, with a cautious optimism, that our commitment to conservation will ensure our waterfowling heritage for generations to come. Now, hopefully our conversation today will chronicle waterfowl hunting in California and help hunters understand our history and our future. It's the story of a time that can never repeat itself, of the era of waterfowl abundance in the Pacific Flyway, and particularly California. That's gone forever. To roam about, you know, in a wealth of waterfowl life, whether it be a river bottom, a swampland, a tidal marsh, or a prairie, to observe such a sylvan life as then most everywhere existed, to hear the call of the mallard, sound of the wood duck, sudden whir of teal, and the varied notes of other living things, to see the graceful motion of the pintail, and to hear the thunderous roar of thousands of geese rising up. It's all these things that I'll attempt to convey today. And for the old-time waterfowlers, the innumerable wild voices intermingling with black powder of the time that filled in the deepest notes, such shootings as today is hardly dreamt of.
So, Yancey, the Sassoon Marsh is historic in its own right. Is that the location where duck clubs started? And why is the Sassoon Marsh still one of those historic sites that's important today?
It's where it all started. And Sassoon Marsh is the largest contiguous brackish water marsh, estuarian marsh, on the west coast of North America. The marsh is part of the San Francisco Bay estuary and is subject to tidal ebb and flow. It's formed by the confluence of the Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers between Martinez and Sassoon City. It's adjacent to Sassoon Bay. The marsh is immediately west of the delta. It consists of peat soil formed by the decaying of emergent plants, mixed with mineral deposits laid down by the delta outflow of the Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers. Now, due to subsidence, it lies several feet below sea level. Of its 116,000 acres, 55,000 acres of wetlands, 29,000 acres are bays and sloughs, and the balance, some 32,000 acres, are of upland habitat. Now, at the time when the first Europeans arrived at the Sassoon Bay in 1769, the local Sassoon and Patwin people had been living on the edge of the Sassoon Marsh in a sustainable and balanced relationship with their natural environment for thousands of years. The Patwin gave the marsh the name Sassoon, which meant the place of the west wind. And boy, I'll tell you, if you've spent any time there, that west wind really blows at times. You know, driving down Highway 680 to the west of it, you know, you got to grab your steering wheel with both both hands.
I want to know why it stops during duck season.
I always make the joke with our hunters that you come out and drop your kids off at summer camp, it's ripping wind, you come out to hunt, it's just going to be nothing.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, and then I want to go on with this description of the marsh, but one thing you don't want to do is hunt the Sassoon Marsh in a rain.
I've heard that.
Rain drives the birds out of the marsh, and it drives me crazy because you think you're going to get over there and it's going to be a big wind and rain, and you're going to have a flight all day long, and you're going to pick and choose your birds. They're gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's true. It drives them out for some reason.
Yeah. Wait for some nice weather for them to come back.
Yeah. I've heard that from the biologists, like right before the rain or wait till they come back after, not once it hits.
You bet. Robert knows it well. Yeah, absolutely. But, long before gold and fertile soil called people with dreams to the West, it was a haven for wildlife. There were millions of migratory waterfowl and other birds that wintered there. And it was home for hundreds of wildlife species, including California's native tule elk and grizzly bears. The marsh was much larger at the time than it is today, and it supported extensive tule growth, and the salty margins of the estuary held vast expanses of pickleweed and large stands of cord grass. Today, only Sassoon Marsh and a few other small San Francisco Bay wetland areas give a true hint of the extraordinary bird and animal life that existed there at that time. Now, the heritage of California duck clubs and duck hunting is truly a rich one, and this is particularly true in the Sassoon Marsh. In many ways, the Sassoon Marsh may be considered the first home of California duck clubs. Over time, there have been some 380 clubs that were established, and today, I think there's about 150 clubs still active. From the gold rush until about 1880, the marsh was extensively used by market hunters to provide fresh waterfowl to San Francisco markets. During a single hunting season, an estimated 250,000 ducks were sold in San Francisco markets, and 350,000 ducks were sold statewide. The west side of the marsh had the first clubs, both for quality and for ease of access. In 1879, the Central Pacific, soon to become the Southern Pacific Railroad, completed a railroad from Benicia to Sassoon City, one of the most railroad-unfriendly environments imaginable, allowing wealthy sport hunters to easily access their leases and eventually their clubs.
Was there an actual train station there, or did they just go club to club and start dropping people off?
And I'm going to get into a little more detail on that, but there were actual stops by particular clubs. We'll explore that a little bit. You'll find it to be very interesting. Flag stops were named Pintail, Teal, Drawbridge, Cygnus. It was, they were again very actually on the borders of the clubs. And later, and for the same reasons, the Sacramento Northern built an electrified rail line crossing the east side of the marsh. Ultimately, the luxury of more leisure time and more money facilitated the development of more organized or club hunting. Now, many claims have been made about being the oldest club in California. Four of the Sassoon clubs vie closely for that honor. Noteworthy, each is still active in the same approximate location as when they were formed. Pretty amazing. First, the clubs were housed in arks and scows and schooners, those belonging to market hunters, and later in the same edifices that they use today. The first, by all accounts, was the Ibis in 1879, the Cordelia in 1880, the Teal in 1882, and the Tule Bell in 1885. Interestingly, however, the Tule Bell can be thought of as actually the oldest in the state if we take into account that they initially in 1862 were located on an arc off the San Mateo coast. You know, of course, San Mateo is just south of San Francisco. And I'll give you a little more information on that later as well. Now, starting in the 1880s, much of the east side of the marsh was converted into agriculture. Dairy farms and cattle ranches came first, and then wheat, asparagus, and potato farms. Now, this was made possible by the construction of levees and dikes to hold back water. Increasing soil salinity, however, made farming unprofitable, and in 1950, it stopped. Over the decades, however, reclamation and agriculture and nearby industrial development had taken their toll. And as the marsh had always supported high numbers of migratory waterfowl, duck clubs and duck hunting now became the main use throughout the marsh, not just on the west side. To maintain healthy wetlands, marshland owners, and in particular duck club owners, successfully sought legislation to preserve the marsh from other forms of development. Now, the marsh is protected under the 1974 Sassoon Marsh Protection Act and the 1976 Sassoon Marsh Protection Act to protect the integrity and ensure continued wildlife use and to maintain habitat for waterfowl. And a lot of the people we know in the waterfowling world were responsible for that. I could name a few of them. The Sino family really stands out in my mind. But some of the Claude Grillo was very involved, and some of the guys that are members of Sassoon Resource Conservation District and the Board of Supervisors in cities of Sassoon and Fairfield were responsible. CWA, of course, was highly involved.
Now, with some of these early clubs, were those ever farmed, like the Teal Club, Cordelia, Tule Bell? Did those ever go into ag at all, or were they always just duck clubs?
They were really just duck clubs. Now, some of the clubs, good question, some of the clubs on the west side, grazing took place.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple attempts were made to grow some regular farm crops, and it just didn't work over there.
Yeah.
You know, originally, there was a lot more fresh water in that area. There are two fairly good-sized streams that flow into the north end of Sassoon Marsh, and then rainwater, of course. But over time, you know, the salinity is what has changed the marsh. They just can't grow saline-tolerant mm-hmm. plants. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, the hunting has changed so dramatically. Sassoon Marsh, let me tell you, you know, I hunted there for 10 years in the famous old Roos Club on the west side. It's right across the railroad tracks from the Teal Club. And now it's the Drake's Brig, of course. And originally, the flights were just amazing. You know, you never went over there wondering if you were going to get your birds. You always shot seven sprig. And you shot, whenever possible, seven bullsprig. It was just amazing. But since that time, that was in the 60s and 70s, you know, it has just become more of a challenge. They still have great clubs. They still have wonderful hunting over there. It's, you know, it's pretty visual.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's pretty obvious that the changes have happened. But a lot of the morning flights over there were birds coming back from an evening of dining on corn in the Delta.
Yeah, I've heard those
stories. And, you know, in Sherman Island and that area, they had amazing hunting because those birds came there first, and, man, they needed to drink some fresh water. You know, they were full of corn, and they just had to drink. And so Sherman Island was amazing. Then, of course, that morning flight in the Sassoon Marsh was also affected by those birds coming back. So the primary land uses in the marsh are the conservation of the 52,000 acres of managed wetlands and wildlife habitat as waterfowl management areas and duck clubs. The marsh has been identified as an area with a high potential, however, for tidal restoration, as well as a prime area to advance habitat conservation to benefit plant and animal species at risk of extinction under the Endangered Species Act. Diminishing habitat and introduced non-native plants have threatened the survival of the marsh and the marsh-dependent species, including the clapper rail, the salt marsh harvest mouse, and the many rare and endemic salt marsh plants. Today, the marsh refuges and many of the duck clubs are engaged in the restoration projects critical to the long-term future of these species. In 1932, the Joyce Island State Wildlife Refuge was established, and then in 1950, the Grizzly Island Waterfowl Management Area was created, both for restoration of wildlife habitat and to create a balance between hunting and conservation. The marsh has had a long history of wetland protection, conservation, and stewardship of its natural resources. In recent years, improvements in marsh management practices have increased the number of waterfowl nesting in the marsh once again. Since 1977, the marsh has been governed by three agencies: the Sassoon Resource Conservation District, bless their hearts, amazing people to work with, the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, by many standards, the historic duck clubs of California have been essential for the continued existence of wetlands and waterfowl in the state. And this has been particularly evident in the Sassoon Marsh, often the only places not drained or converted to agriculture and other economic development have been duck clubs who own their own land. Waterfowl hunting and managed wetland conservation have been the main way of life and cultural linkage to the land for Sassoon Marsh and the landowners for several generations now. Today, duck hunters' devotion to the care of the marsh is extensive and at considerable personal expense. Without the hunting club, Sassoon Marsh, as we know it, would probably not exist. So what is the long-term future of Sassoon Marsh? There's no doubt that it will continue to function as open space and as an important habitat for wildlife, fish, and plants, although aquatic salt-tolerant species will become increasingly important. The degree to which this happens depends on how fast climate change and the resulting rise in seawater will cause permanent flooding.
Got a few questions about Sassoon in general. So when these clubs started, you know, talked about the Europeans coming and the Indians were already there, how did they go about acquiring the actual land to start these clubs? Like, where were they purchased from? Who owned the land at that point?
Oh, good question. Excuse me. Of course, there was an amazing act enacted in 1849 nationally, but in 1850 in California, and it was called the Swamps and Overflowed Lands Act. And this was an act that allowed the state to sell, quote-unquote, swamp land, most of which to be reclaimed, particularly for agriculture. So that was the legal entity that did it. And, the first people, of course, to go into Sassoon Marsh were the market hunters. And the two most famous, the names that we read about the most, there were about 10 or 12 pretty famous guys, but the two most famous were Seth Beckwith and Jim Payne. And they came into the marsh in 1852. Have to imagine what it was like leaving San Francisco to come to the marsh with their sloops and other boats. It could take them up to 3 days, depending on the wind, to get there. But at the beginning time that they were there, they had indescribable hunting. They would they had other companies coming, because it took so long to get the birds to market. They had other companies that they employed just to come and pick their birds up and take them to San Francisco market. But they'd come about every 2 to 3 days to pick the birds up, and they'd have 8 to 10 sacks ready each time with 5 to 6 dozen birds. It was absolutely amazing.
Are these fully clean birds by the time they're picking them up, or
nope,
they just
nope.
put them in the gunny sack?
They put them in the gunny sack and send them on their way. And I don't know if you've ever done it. I spent a lot of time in Europe and did a lot of hunting and fishing in Europe, especially Western Europe. But even today, you can still walk through towns and you can go past a butcher market or a market. You're going to see game hanging outside. And, you know, not in the heat, of course, but you're going to see game hanging outside. So I've tried that here in California. And I mean, in the heart of winter, when it's still pretty cold, I brought my birds home. I'm tired. I don't want to touch a bird. I'll hang them up in my rafters of my garage where it's nice and cold. It might be 3 or 4 days before I touch them. And we all know, it's a well-known fact with all meats, that aging them in most instances, you know, really enhances the tenderness and flavor. And I find that if it's cold enough, you don't need to clean ducks right away. It's the best thing to do, of course.
Yeah.
But you don't need to.
Right. Our hunt program is still accepting applications for pick hunts. Our fall applications will open July 12th. Go to calwaterfowl.org to apply today. We still have a membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Real Tree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. Some of our upcoming events include CWA Bingo and Tunes in Roseville on July 17th, our Chino Banquet July 31st, and our Santa Margarita Banquet on August 2nd. Go to calwaterfowl.org to find more information. And now, like Joyce Island, you know, back in the heyday, it was known for primarily mallard hunting, right? And then they had the firing line there. Carson's dad, I think, shot his first duck on the firing line of Joyce, didn't he?
Now, you're talking about the Joyce Island Duck Club?
I'm talking about the wildlife area.
The wildlife area.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I've heard some stories. Was that a place that they were trying to attract ducks to get them off of crops or something like that, where they were actually actively baiting ducks for a long time and then stopped? Have you ever seen or heard of any of that?
Well, that's a practice that took place throughout anywhere that duck hunting is taking place. But in California, that had a great deal to do with the first refuges coming into the state to get the birds out of agricultural lands. You know, and uniquely, Sacramento Refuge and the federal refuge at Tule Lake, they did the same thing. You know, I mean, they actually, let me rephrase that. They actually grew products on the refuge to try to hold the ducks there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these birds, they could listen, huge number of ducks or geese could go into a rice ranch and they could eat 5 acres a night, literally eat 5 acres a night. So yeah. Now, Joyce Island itself, you know, when it was developed in 31, there still was agriculture in the refuge area or in the Grizzly Island area. So, yeah, part of it was to pull the ducks out of there, but part of it was developed to have a combination of both hunting and refuge for the birds.
Now, these market hunters, are they shooting ducks in flight? Are they punt gunning back in the day? I mean, they're obviously sailing across the bay to get there. They're spending who knows how long and never leaving. How are they actually harvesting the ducks? What was the number one way to do it?
Yeah. So what they would do is they would, even though they would come in their scows and sloops and tow arks with them and live on those and everything, they still had smaller boats. They had the Thule boats, the double enders. They had,
skull boats,
excuse me. And I mean, my God, anyway, I owned one too myself for years, but, they would go into the marshlands to hunt usually with, those boats. And then they would pull the double enders and they would, do the final, approaches to the ponds that they were going to hunt. and they would go into the ponds, and as they did, they would tell, either they themselves would wait, or in the 1880s, late 70s and 80s, when they started bringing in people that would come from San Francisco to hunt at $5 a day, by the way, which is a lot of money then, they would tell them, do not shoot ducks as we pull into the ponds. And they'd go into those ponds and they'd actually throw out some decoys and then they'd start shooting. And of course, the prime bird at that time was canvasback. And they would try to focus on them. And then they had a declining scale of what was the premier birds, but they shot a lot of sprig, they shot a lot of teal. And then they even shot the spoonbills and the other divers, the redheads and so on and so forth. But the prime bird was the canvasback. And there were days where they'd shoot, these market hunters would shoot a couple of hundred each, you know. And even when the sport hunters came in with them, there are many, many records of guys shooting 150 or so ducks a day. And of course, it's, you know, you think about this when it was done initially, it was all black powder, you know, and trying to reload and this and that. And they would bring several guns with them, but they were shooting 4th and 6th grade, guns. The only thing they used a 12 gauge was to kill cripples with. You know, it was a little bit of 10 gauge, but it was mostly 4 and 6 gauge. And they'd fire the first shot while the birds were still on the water, and the second shot while the birds lifted up. And sometimes that might result, between those two shots, close to 200 birds.
Wow.
Yeah. It was. Can you imagine the amount of birds that had to be there?
No. Were they baiting those areas, or was it mostly just birds?
They didn't have to bait it then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Baiting started when clubs started.
Clubs were coming.
And, you know, it was legal. It was legal up to the 30s. They could bait. And just to tell you a little history of that, an interesting part of it, the last legal baiting, let's call it feeding. It was called feeding, but legally it was, you know, it really was baiting, took place in Southern California. And the last baiting took place up to about 1980. And there were a lot of clubs, not a significant number of clubs still in the area down there, especially in the Point Magoo area, the Mystic Lake area, the Salton Sea, amazing hunting in the Salton Sea at that time. And they were allowed to bait. They were allowed to put feed out. It was wheat primarily. But they had to enter into a particular program with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do that. And interestingly, the clubs really abided by the rules. You know, it was such a bonus for them to be able to do that, that there was no need to do anything that was illegal, and they really complied with the rules. And the major rule, well, there's two rules. Number one, you had to put out so much poundage every week in wheat. It's expensive. And the second rule was that no blind could be set up within 200 yards of those piles. They'd put it in a big pile. I've got some great photographs and piles as big as this room that we're in right now. And the interesting thing is that the sprig would learn to circle this high in the air, and they'd come down in a spiral motion, land on this wheat. And it was usually as the birds were leaving the wheat, you know, that they'd get shot by the club.
You said
members.
Up to the 1980s?
Yeah. Now, it's an interesting story. And let me tell you this. Well, I'll tell you that, then I want to jump back to the history that preceded that and why that all came about. Our favorite organization, CWA, was intimately involved in that closing. Not by choice, but because they had been requested. So they were approached by the Fish and Game Department, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, actually, and they were asked two questions. First of all, can you grow natural food in the Salton Sea area? And their answer was yes. You know, they had that expertise and they were willing to work with the clubs and teach them how to do that. Second question, would it be better for them to eat natural food?
or wheat.
Well, wheat, like corn, it's like candy, yeah. You know, yeah. It's they love it. The birds can't stay away from it, but it doesn't provide all the nutritional values needed. So CWA answered honestly, no, it's better to have natural foods. Well, those two things were the nails in the coffin in Fish and Wildlife Service. And it really was because they were being promoted by animal rights organizations and everything required them to stop feeding. Now, where did this all get started? It started in the area of the Salton Sea, the Imperial Valley, which was a major, still is, but was a major agricultural area, and they were growing lettuce. Guess what loved lettuce? Widgeon.
Which house?
They could not.
The Widgeonators.
You know, we see Widgeon eating grass today.
Yeah.
Right?
Lettuce.
Well, anyways, so the Widgeon devoured these lettuce crops. They had so many that the farmers were paying. As a matter of fact, it was regulated that there was a multi-year period of time where hunters were at the request of farmers who had the right permits were allowed to go out and shoot them all night long. I mean, it was a serious issue. So they developed this feeding program, and guess what it did? Did nothing. The Widgeon preferred the lettuce. They kept going out there. And
I need to plant some lettuce.
But you know what it
That's
did?
That's the strangest thing.
It started bringing in.
Yeah.
Now, most of the sprig in the L.A. Basin area, people, there's a misnomer. They think, you know, it's part of the migration route, the regular migration route. Well, the birds that go up and down the coastal areas, and I hope we have time to talk about Southern California coastal because it was amazing. But the coastal areas, most of those all were part of the migration, the typical migration. They'd actually migrate down the coast or parts of the Central Valley and then go over the Tehachapi and come in. But the area, the birds that were, you know, closer to the Mystic Lake area, to the Salton Sea, to the interior desert hunting areas, and there were some fabulous, there still is a couple great clubs in there. they came out of the Great Basin. And it's all documented. You go to the Mystic Lake Club, and you look up on the wall, and there is a map with pins in it of all the bands of birds that they've gotten there. 90% of them come out of the Great Basin. Wow. Pretty good documentation.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So that's like where those lines that's where them. All those sprig came from.
Yeah.
So the end result of that feeding program closing, and I'm just talking some factual politics, not making a judgment, just passing on some information to you. Most of the clubs in Southern California were totally dismayed because it really did affect the sprig shooting when they shut it off. But they had to find somebody to blame. Well, who did they blame?
CWA.
Well, you know what? Again, CWA was part of an amicus brief, and they answered those two questions. Nothing else to do with it. It's not their fault.
Interesting.
But since then, as you're well aware, CWA has been invited down to a lot of the clubs in the Salton Sea to convert their marshlands from sprig habitat to mallard habitat. I got to go down. Matter of fact, you know, the great hunt program that CWA offers, when it first started, sent in my applications and actually got won one of the hunts. And it was down on the Salton Sea at the Mecca Club. And the Mecca Club is one of the most famous clubs down there. It's at the north end. It's near the little town of Mecca. Great family owns it. Historically famous area. And so I went down and I'm thinking, well, this will be interesting. You know, not a big club, 160 acres and about 90 to 100 acres of it are water. And the way they set it up was very smart. they put a sanctuary in the far corner, about a 25-acre sanctuary. So birds would fly across their marsh to get to the sanctuary. So they harvested birds going in and out, which is one of the smartest ways to use sanctuaries, of course. But I had a full limit of mallard and a sprig in my one hunt there. So can the hunting still be good in the Salton Sea? Yes, it can. And, you know, of course, the refuge at the south end, the Winster, and other refuges down there, they still shoot a lot of birds, primarily snow geese. But pretty neat here. Yeah. Long way to tell you a story about the feeding program, but it did exist, and it was quite efficient.
Yeah, I want to get back to the Susu Marsh because I have another question. The pigs in the marsh, were they introduced later, or did they come with the Europeans?
Well, there is a specific spot. Now, you know, of course, we know that the Europeans brought pigs with them. And so the pigs in California are essential feral. They are a mixture, you know, of those birds. Of course, faunal succession means that they grow tusks within one generation when they're in the wild because they need to use to root, you know, use their mouths, and that original structure is still in their mouths. But in Sassoon Marsh, up near the little town of Cordelia, there's a great, great a property there. And I'm sure, I know you guys know this fella, and you know the property. And it's Pete Smith's property. And Pete has a great, and he would not be offended at me about mentioning this because it's said with a great deal of affection. But Pete is known by his good friends as Piggy Smith. Now, why Piggy Smith? he's a very generous guy. He's his body is well taken care of. He doesn't have an ounce of fat on him. Why call him Piggy Smith? Well, his father, among other things, had a large pig farm there. And when the farming ended, a lot of those animals, you know, were released, and a lot had gotten loose during the times. So probably, you know, there's not a great deal of number of pigs in the marsh, but the two places that are known for them are the Volante Club and Joyce Island Mallard Farm. And there's some across the slough from them also. I know of instances, I've seen pigs out there myself, but I know of instances of, you know, a dozen being taken a year off of a particular club.
Yeah, but there's some at Rush Ranch, and gosh, we went years without ever seeing them. And then like high tide, you're like, wow, there's
right there. Every high tide, I can look over there right past the bridge, and it's like, there they are.
Yeah.
And what about the name Grizzly Island? So I think it's spelled like grizzly bear. But wasn't there some early accounts?
No, it didn't have anything to do
with it. Yeah, it was like, meaning it was a terrible place to be.
It was a horrible place to be. And it really was tough living there originally. You know, it gets hot. There were a lot of mosquitoes. It was really tough getting farming started there, primarily dairy farming. But then they grew some products too. Asparagus were very successfully grown. Some wheat, potatoes, and... You know, because of salt intrusion, it finally failed. The farms finally gave up in total in about 1950.
That's crazy because there's still some asparagus at Denverton. I picked some this spring for the first time. I was with one of our biologists. He's like, oh, there's some asparagus. And I was like, well, where's it from? He's like, oh, they used to farm it back in the day. And there's still some spots.
Well, it's a root structure, you know. And unless you dig the whole root out of the ground, they're going to grow back.
It was great. I had a whole... bundle of asparagus I brought home.
Well, you know, and the Delta, of course, you know, Delta's known for its corn. But let me tell you, you can't believe, not just, and tomatoes are very big over there too, but you can't believe the asparagus that are grown in the Delta. You have never eaten better vegetables in your life. They are absolutely amazing. And the places where they were planted, you know, they cut them and they grow back up and they get a second or even a third growth during the season.
That's amazing. When did the name Grizzly Island change to like grizzly bear, you know, like that's what people think. Oh, there's grizzly bears out here. But like, when did the spelling change? Because it was like grizzly, like meaning a terrible place. And now it's G-R-I-Z-Z-L-Y. Is there any record of that?
Well, it changed in the late teens, early 20s.
Okay.
You know, and that's when most of the farming really took place there. And, you know, of course, the successful farming anyways. But, of course, as soon as the farming was completed there, multiple new clubs came in. The land was sold and all, and the new clubs developed. And that's one of the great things about the Sassoon Marsh, because although it was primarily peopled by wealthy men, especially from the San Francisco Bay Area and the East Bay, it's a place where, quote unquote, where the common man could hunt. Matter of fact, 1887, I believe it was the first association put together to benefit the common man's hunting. And it was put together in San Francisco with the purpose of getting hunting areas for the common man. And I use that term, that's the term that they use. The average guy, you know, the average Joe, the working stiff. And what happened was, you know, after the market hunters, there was the first person to really come in and purchase a large piece of land was, well, the family, the Chamberlain family, and primarily Oscar Chamberlain got involved there. And they bought 5,000 acres of the very best land on the west side. Actually, you know, I would say the northwest side, from where the town of Cordelia is today, all the way down to the family club in that area.
Oh, wow.
You know,
it's a big chunk.
You know, Pierce Landing in
that
area.
Yeah.
It was a big chunk. And so anyways, they bought that through the overflowed lands and swamp act that I had mentioned to you about. They bought it in 1868.
Do you know what they paid?
Yes, I do. Dollar an acre.
Oh my goodness.
Dollar an acre. And, you know, when they got ready to sell it, by the way, just coincidentally, they tried to sell it to Southern Pacific Railroad at 75 cents an acre. Railroad turned them down.
What?
You know? So they wound up, the first guy to buy the whole place was, his last name was Maskey. But in the interim, in the 70s and 80s, you know, all the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, Seth Beckwith and Jim Payne went in there and leased it. And they were providing hunting for the San Francisco sports, who would go there and hunt with them at $5 a day. Pretty expensive. You know, they had leased it. Matter of fact, they had the first lease on wetlands in California. And then eventually it was sold. But in the interim, the four prime, you know, first clubs were developed in California, and they were developed on that land in an area that's called the Pringle Ponds. And then an area, the Thick Broom Pond. And the first one, it's highly acknowledged that this is accurate, except these four clubs, they have some lively conversation among themselves at times about who's actually first and second, and they'll all claim that they're the first at some point. But 1879, the Ibis Club was the first formed, and you can see the Ibis. You know where the Pacific Flyway Center is on 680. Just as you pass that, the next area of wetland, contiguous to that, by the way, is the Ibis Club.
Okay.
And then 1880 was the Cordelia Club. And then the 1881 was the Teal Club. And then 1885 was the Tule Belle. Now, the Tule Bell's got an interesting history if you're interested in that. They actually, if you can take into consideration the fact that that club was formed elsewhere and it was on an arc, it wasn't called.
When you're talking an arc, what do you mean by that?
Noah's Ark.
How big are these arcs?
These arcs are, and I don't know, have the exact dimensions.
Yeah, about.
But I would say, like, the size. If you've seen a tugboat, I would say about half the size of a tugboat. You know,
like a little wooden houseboat.
You know, they could sleep several people, and they had a kitchen area, maybe a couch and a couple of chairs.
A floating duck club.
Yeah, exactly. It was a floating duck club. Anyway, so the Cordelia Club was on an arc off the Belmont coast. And the Belmont area today, of course, is south of San Francisco, about a half hour's drive, 20-minute drive south of San Francisco. And the marshland over, matter of fact, the whole Bay Area is being reclaimed now back to natural marsh as much as possible. But one of the famous names over in Belmont, the person who really developed it, the last name of Ralston. Well, Ralston was one of the two owners of this ARC, this club. It wasn't called the Tule Bell at the time. The ARC was called the Tule Bell, but not the club. Was. It was called the Belmont Club.
So it would be like almost naming a boat.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And
all sails and oars. Right? Huh? All sails and oars. Like there's no power, no nothing.
No power whatsoever. And the other name was Parrot. Now, Parrot is known because of the Parrot land grant, which became Llano Seco. You know, and anyway, so they were both highly wealthy and successful people at the time. Parrot owned gold mines, you know, and a lot of property, of course. At the time, Ralston was developing Belmont, but he also had the owning share in the largest gold mine in California. And so these were very wealthy men. So anyways, they were there for several years. And as the hunting changed and more clubs started to develop, and there were a lot of clubs in the contiguous Bay Area. And as they began to develop, they took their arc over to Sherman Island. Now, Sherman Island is interesting because it's considered either the start of the Delta, if you're going east, or the end of Sassoon Marsh area, Sassoon Bay, going west, you know. So, but one way or the other, they took it over there and they anchored it and they gave it their best effort. But the hunting turned out to be horrible there at that time. Now, since they left, it's like almost immediately after they left, came over to the Thick Broom property in Western Sassoon Marsh, hunting turned around and it became fabulous over there.
What was the big change? Was there a ag? Was there something else going on?
Well, I'll tell you, it was amazing, but they flooded it, and what came in was catfish and other fish like that, and they started destroying the foliage. They started eating it all, and it turned into a big mud hole. And you know, interesting dynamic, but that's what happened. They left, came over to Sassoon Marsh. Now, if you consider them, their club being that arc, then that was the first. But Ibis is really considered the first club actually in California. Now, at the same time, a couple of years later, the Recreation Club formed in Southern California, which is one of the most famous clubs that was ever down there. It was close to Playa del Mar. And that was an amazing, the Bologna Marsh there was absolutely amazing. And again, you know, we'll have a chance to chat about Southern California. We got to do that at some point.
Absolutely. And back to the market days in Sassoon. So obviously there's Thule elk there. Were these folks also harvesting Thule elk and selling them on the market? Was that something that people did?
The Thule elk, after, you know, the market hunters, everywhere that there were market hunters in California, they initially were hunting game, you know, big game.
Yeah.
They were hunting the elk, the bears, the antelope, excuse me, the deer. And by the time that they'd really been in business for a while, it started really dying off. And they just couldn't easily make a living doing that anymore. You know, one of the most famous fellows that did all that was a guy named Grizzly Adams. And most people, having watched TV 60, 70 years ago, thinks that Grizzly Adams was a TV character. He was a real person, and he has a fabulous history about his background. But he shot a lot of grizzly bears, and that's how he made his living originally, till he started capturing some animals, and he developed a menagerie. And he would take them to places like he'd trained them, because he got them as cubs and fawns and so on and so forth. And there's great stories about him going to San Francisco in the 70s and 80s and renting a hall and having his menagerie perform. And the very end of his life in the 90s, he took the train and his entire menagerie back to New York City, and he rented a hall using his menagerie there, and then he died shortly thereafter, and all those animals went to private zoos, so on. But you know, just another interesting character in our history.
Yeah, wow.
But anyway, so everything was primarily big game for market hunters originally, and when that game no longer became easily accessible, they switched to wildfowl, and not just ducks and geese, but shorebirds and proliferation, and even quail. Quail hunting in California at the turn of the century was as good as the duck hunting.
Oh, wow.
The limit was 50 a day, and anybody could go out and get their limit day after day after day. It was absolutely amazing. So anyways, the wildfowl, you know, became the main game, and the Suisun Marsh, you know, again, Suisun Marsh helped to feed the gold miners in San Francisco for years. Very, very famous. And, you know, same situation in all the marshes. Butte Sink, when we talk about that, you know, it was initially a place where the big game market hunters hunted. And then about 1890, when the game was no longer readily available, it turned to duck hunting. Market hunting, and then of course the clubs. We'll talk about that a little later. So in 67, the railroad was being built. It was finished in 69, and it was a short line. It went from Benicia to Fairfield, and nicely opened up some of the sloughs over there that people could get to. Montezuma Slough being one of the main ones. But the first sports from San Francisco to use the Suisun Marsh were very wealthy people. And when they started buying their land and putting their clubs in the Suisun Marsh, leasing them first and then buying them, they talked their good friends who owned the Central Pacific Railroad and then the Southern Pacific into building this railroad. Now, the railroad was going to go in anyways. It was going to go from Benicia to Suisun, but it was going to go higher up,
yeah,
in firmer land up kind of where 680 is today.
Not a smart place to put it.
But they talked them into putting it down so they could easily access their clubs. It ran right next to their clubs, you know, and of course it's still there today. And if you spend any time over there, you'll see those trains come by, freight and passenger trains. By the way, I might mention, you can go from the East Bay. Not the East Bay, you can go from near where the San Francisco Bay Bridge starts over in that area, you know, near Berkeley and everything. You can catch the train today, and it's a wonderful day trip. You can ride this all the way to Sacramento, have lunch, visit around and come back and see a lot of the areas that were hunted originally that you wouldn't get to see from the highway.
Right.
So it's a nice thing to consider. But anyways, they talked him into putting these stops in, and they were teal and Cygnus and drawbridge. And, you know, they would start where the family club is now, and then they would go to the teal club area. Then they would go to where the Jackknife club is today, and they had a stop there, and then a little further north. And not only would they allow these guys to get on and off the train, you know, depending on which direction they're going, but sometimes in some areas they built some side rails where for special events, they'd bring in a car, drop it off on the side rail, and that could be used for the party or for additional places for their many, many, many guests to sleep. And then the car would be picked back up at the end of the weekend and taken back to San Francisco. But, you know, again, they didn't like the idea that it took them up to 3 days to sail up to Suisun Marsh. So again, they talked him into putting this railroad in closer to them. Now, the dilemma, of course, is that they built it on peat soil. And immediately, tracks started sinking. So they're constantly having to put new gravel underneath and build it back up. And today, there are sections in there that are 90 feet below the original place where the tracks were. It is considered... You know, you always think about going through blasting their way through the Sierras and everything. This is supposed to be mile for mile, the most expensive tracks ever laid in the railroad.
No way.
I'm assuming that the owners were also duck hunters or guests of these clubs to make it like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. That's where it came from. They were duck hunters.
Were they owners of any clubs?
Well, initially they leased the properties, but yeah, then they bought the clubs.
No, the actual railroad owners were they any members of like the Ibis or Teal or any of
not
those?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure they were. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you, but there's no question they were guests there.
Yeah.
You know, but not that I'm aware. Not that I've read that any of them were owners. But you know, the railroads. Just to mention this. The changes, hunting in California was a challenge initially in the sense that great effort had to be made to get to a spot where duck, you know, people duck hunted. And initially, duck clubs were really, the definition has really changed over time. Initially, it was a group of guys that got together and went somewhere to hunt. And initially, because it took so much effort, they would go by horse and buggy, you know, perhaps, and they'd go for a day, 2-3 days ride, and they'd set up camp. They'd hunt for 2 weeks and then come back. That was their hunt, or maybe they'd do that twice. But with the change in transportation, hunting evolved in California, and it evolved dramatically, and it evolved overnight. The first change in transportation was, of course, the railroad, and railroads. Small lines, longer lines were built everywhere in California, primarily because of agriculture, you know, initially getting to where they could pick up the products, but also to population centers and so on and so forth. But now, you know, clubs changed to a place, to a name, to where hunters would primarily hunt. That was their prime location they hunted. And they could access heretofore difficult places to get to rather quickly on the trains. And then, of course, after the trains, the automobile was developed. And it was the automobile in Southern California that made the big difference. You know, the major population area down there initially was the L.A. Basin. And the major clubs, there were a lot of clubs between downtown LA coast in normal wetland areas.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the clubs were actually on the coast. And the reason they existed so long was that was primarily agricultural land because there wasn't really transportation to get them out there. It took a long time to get out there. And so two things happened. One small rail line got developed, and that was by Huntington. He ran his own personal train out there. It was an electric train. It went to the Bolsa Chica, you know, unquestionably one of the most famous clubs ever in California. But then the advent of the automobile early in the 1900s allowed people to get out there from downtown. Talking about downtown LA, believe it or not, there was actually duck hunting in La Brea tar pits at one time because the tar pits were strange. Covered by water. So they had unique ways of getting them out of the tar pit.
Oh my gosh.
You know, but nonetheless, they shot ducks in downtown LA.
Yeah.
You know,
that's wild.
And I know I'm talking, I keep wanting to bird walk, so to speak, and get back to LA Basin, but don't let me interrupt you too much. So trains, very, very, transportation in general, but trains very, very important in opening up California to hunting by in a variety of places and by a variety of people. By the way, you know, hunting in California was really, it was pervasive, especially waterfowl hunting, absolutely pervasive. It was a humongous sociological phenomenon. All walks of life, all professions got involved. As a matter of fact, every governor prior to Newsom hunted. You know, people say, Jerry Brown? Sure, Jerry Brown hunted prior to going to the seminary. But, you know, his dad, Pat Brown, I mean, I could tell you stories for hours about Pat Brown, who hunted primarily at Venice Island, but a lot of other places there. But, you know, another group of hunters that hunted, very well-known people, were our movie stars. And people like Bing Crosby and Andy Devine and all of the guys that played in the Westerns and everything. You know, and of course, Clark Gable. These fellas all hunted. And they hunted initially, or at least primarily, in the lower end of the San Joaquin Valley and what's called the Tulare Basin. There were fabulous cubs there up till our losses of water like in 1970. But these guys would go, and they would party all Friday night. They'd go over to Hatchby's, get there in time. They had a couple of favorite restaurant bars to go to, and they'd party all Friday night. You know, sometimes never even go to bed. Go hunt, have a fabulous hunt in the morning, get their limits, hop in their cars, and be back to work by 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And they came up to other areas, too. You know, I've got some great photographs of Bing Crosby and Andy Devine at the family club.
Yeah, I saw a picture of Babe Ruth at the family club when I was there.
Well, did you? Yeah, Babe? Because, yeah. See, Babe, there's the famous photograph of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig.
Lou Gehrig, yeah.
Matter of fact, I brought that.
Oh, you did?
That photograph into California, but it was at the Bolsa Chica Club in the 30s, and it was the same year that both Gehrig hit his record and Ruth hit his record. And I did a lot of research on that, and I found out where those Packards came from, downtown L.A., those beautiful cars that were there. And they all had high-dollar side-by-side Parkers with them. You know, those were very expensive guns, even in those days. But that's a great photograph, and, of course, a very, very famous club, which all changed once they discovered oil.
And, oh, really?
And I'll tell you what, you think those guys were wealthy enough when they joined? You can't believe the abundance of dollars falling out of their pockets when they left there. It was absolutely amazing. Plus, it was a fabulous place to hunt, you know. Incredible clubhouse. They had these catered meals coming out of the clubhouse to the blind, you know. Just an amazing place. Interestingly, in during World War II, and this spot is still there, you can visit it, when conservation groups took the marsh back over and got it redeveloped, got it reclaimed and developed back into tidal marsh. Prior to that time, World War II, there was a gun emplacement on the property right on the coast highway, and I mean a big gun emplacement where if you know, any submarines or battleships or anything showed up from Japan or other places, you know, they'd be able to fire on them right from there. And that gun emplacement's still there. You can visit it.
It's actually on the club where it
is. Yes, actually on the club, right on the edge of Coastal Highway.
Wow.
That clubhouse burnt down, sadly. I've got some great photographs of the old clubhouse. But and then, you know, royalty hunted there.
Yeah.
People from, you know, accounts from Europe and other great people down there.
What about Susu Marsh? What famous people and pictures you have from there? People coming in through the trains?
I've got a lot of pictures, but they're primarily just, there's some famous photographs that I've got that most collectors have that are of the arcs and the sloughs, the Lolita and the Wave, where the market hunters and then their sports from San Francisco stayed. Matter of fact, the Wave became the first clubhouse at the Teal Club. Jim Payne leased his favorite pond, the Payne Pond, to the Teely Club originally, and then, of course, they bought their property. And I mean, there's a multiple long story about how it changed hands and all that. It was horrible infighting at some point between the clubs, and once the leases took place and everything, that the average guy came in and he couldn't hunt anymore, so he started poaching.
Mm.
Horrible problems, even among the clubs, among themselves, shooting at each other and so on. And this all changed eventually in the 1890s when a law was passed in California. And clubs could post themselves. Prior to that time, there was no posting. You couldn't post the land.
Couldn't post.
Another big change when you could finally put barbed wire around a property like that. And if a land was barbed wired, you couldn't cross it. But so that law is what changed.
Hmm.
And then again, the average guy at that point started putting groups together and buying properties and starting clubs. Interestingly, clubs, you know, how they named was very interesting. It was either through the name of the guy that bought it, if it was just a single guy, or where they were from. A lot of places were named for the town that they were from, or by the names, the old original names, the ponds.
Mm-hmm.
That might be the name of the club. And so anyways, I had started to tell you about, so the Ark was brought in to the Teal Club. And by the way, that one and another one that was later brought in were grounded, and that's the basis for the Teal Club today. Andrew Brogan, the prime owner at Teal Club, went in there initially before he brought in partners and committed himself to rebuilding that. And it is without question one of the coolest duck clubhouses in the world. And if you ever haven't been in there,
is that where I dropped off the New Zealand hunter last year or 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you walk through and it has all the rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they like restored everything.
Oh, yeah. It restored everything. It was the
coolest thing ever when I walked through
there. And they left the tilt on the main hallway in place. And it's amazing to walk through there. And I mean, these guys are the best hosts in the world.
Yeah.
Bar none. And they put on amazing dinners there. And they're just, so happy to have guests there and so on. Just great guys. You know, like so many places, you know, the hunting can be a challenge at times. But they love their place and they're maintaining the history very, very well there. And the old Ark, you know, that they brought in, made out of redwood. And I've crawled underneath it and photographed back in there, and it's the real deal.
Yeah.
It's not a story they made up. But, and I, you know, nicely in the 60s and 70s hunted right across the railroad tracks. It was originally the Roost Club, then the RBM, and then again, some of the Sino family and DaVincenzi and Grillo, Claude Grillo, bought that club in the 70s, and they've done a wonderful job with it over time.
Now when the I think you called it the Wetland and Marsh Act or whatever it was, Swamp Act. If you wanted to go buy those lands, was it just literally like you went out there with some stakes and staked your land of that's the portion that you wanted to buy? Is that how that worked?
You had to make a commitment to reclaim it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they checked on that. Other times they didn't. Initially they didn't. And there's that classic old photo down in the San Joaquin Valley of a wagon with a boat on it. And they photographed it in such a way as you see the boat and the agricultural land around it. So you had to develop it.
Gotcha.
Did you just go to the city and say, hey, I'm taking this X amount? How did you actually claim it?
You had to go in with geographical information. It's an exact location. And then you had to go through a series of paperwork and so on. I mean, it was not really challenging. They would help you do it because they wanted the land developed because it brought income to the state. See what else I can tell you about that. That's interesting. Originally, only 160 acre parcels were allowed per person.
Mm.
But of course, they got around that in a variety of ways. For example, when Fryant Dam was built, damming the Kings River in the late 40s, Boswell and some of the other large landholding companies down there, they were industrial agriculture, they would go in and claim that they were 160 acres, but they actually would get hundreds of people to go file this paperwork and get their 160 acres and turn it over to the big industrial agricultural companies. So that was done throughout the state.
Wow.
Very common practice.
Yeah. Wow. Well, let's pause with that history on Sassoon, and let's take a little break.
Tune in next week as we dive into the rich history of Northeastern California, primarily the Klamath Basin, and then we'll work our way down the flyway to the Butte Sink. Tune in next week.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.